And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave. Go home to my Lord and be free.
Stuart Burns's newly revised book, To the Mountaintop, is the history of a turbulent time that changed the course of American and world history. Moral warrior and nonviolent apostle, man of God rocked by fury, fear, and guilt, national thinker driven by emotional and spiritual truth, Martin Luther King Jr. struggled to reconcile these divisions in his soul. Burns provides a narrative of his intellectual and spiritual journey from cautious liberal to reluctant radical to righteous revolutionary. He draws not only on King's speeches, letters, writings, and well-reported strategizing and activities, but also in previously underutilized oral histories of key meetings and events, which present a dramatic account of King and the movement in the crucial years, especially from 1955 to 1968. Burns is the former editor of the Martin Luther King Jr. papers at Stanford University. He produced the Montgomery Bus Boycott volume, Birth of a New Age. He published the first history of the bus boycott, Daybreak of Freedom, which was later made into the HBO feature film, Boycott, and he has taught at the University of California, Stanford, Antioch University, and Williams College. It is a great pleasure to welcome Stuart Burns to the roundtable. Stuart, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
A great pleasure to have you on the program. The book is new in the sense that you have worked on it more, brought out a new edition, revised it. Give us a sense of the original project of what led you to it.
To the original that came out 15 years ago.
Correct.
I had been a King scholar for 15 years before that. I had been an editor of the King papers at Stanford University, where I edited the first volume and worked on other volumes. And then I had written a book on the Montgomery bus boycott, which was made into an HBO film called Boycott. And so I had been pretty much concentrating on King for 15 years before that. The book took me about 10 years altogether to write, but the final draft took about a year.
The way the book is broken up of Mighty Stream, Middle Passage, Crossing to Jerusalem. Just give us a sense. We'll go individually here in a moment, but give us a sense of breaking it up that way and how you decided to tackle such a large subject.
Well, that was one way that I decided to tackle it, was by dividing it into what I call three books, so that at least in the first edition, it wasn't completely inclusive of, you know, all the events that happened. Actually, in the new edition, it is more inclusive. So there were some gaps in the original edition, partly because the publisher gave me so little time to finish it. But in the new edition, I closed those gaps. But the idea is that there were three significant periods of King's life that had real differences. And the first was when he first got started and took over leadership of the Montgomery bus boycott, not by choice, but by acclamation by the black community. It was the last thing he expected, and he was very new to any kind of political action, and so that was a whole new beginning for him. Then the second middle passage, which of course refers to the transportation of slaves in a brutal way across the Atlantic Ocean in what was called the Middle Passage. And then the final edition is the final book is when King really went through the greatest change and had come out against the Vietnam War and putting his life even more in jeopardy than ever before, and decided to not only come out against the war, but to come out strongly against corporate capitalism in his quest to eliminate the triple evils of racism, poverty, and militarism.
Let us talk about the Montgomery boycott, and as you say, being somewhat ambivalent to be a leader of a movement. At what point do you feel that he found his voice, found his footing, and realized that he was good at it?
One of the astonishing things, which really shows, you know, there's been criticism of King because occasionally he used ghost writers and collaborators on various books that he wrote, or even sermons. But here was a clear-cut example where he had never given a political speech before. And on the night of December 5th, 1955, at Holt Street Baptist Church in Montgomery, the first mass meeting of the Montgomery Bus Boycott, he had just been chosen to be president of this new, brand-new organization, the Montgomery Improvement Association, to lead the boycott. And he gave a talk that was really more like a sermon that night, that was one of the most powerful sermons he ever gave. And he had just had about 20 minutes to prepare it and had just scribbled down some notes. And so you see King almost extemporaneously giving a talk that stands up with any other sermon he gave later on. And it really is one of the most powerful. And it motivated the people of Montgomery, the black people of Montgomery, to take the risk of continuing the boycott, which was not what they had originally. It was going to be a one-day boycott.
Right.
And then he and the other preachers motivated them to continue on for what turned out to be 381 days.
When, and just because I'm curious of his self-awareness, of a realization that he had that what he was doing was accomplishing something.
Yes. Of course, a lot of times he despaired about feeling that he was not accomplishing much. And certainly with the bus boycott, it didn't look like, for the first 6 months, it didn't look like they were accomplishing much of anything, because they were getting this relentless opposition from the city authorities in all kinds of ways. But it was when the Browder v. Gale federal court lawsuit that the bus boycott filed in February 1956, when the local federal court in Montgomery voted 2-1 that the bus segregation was unconstitutional. That's when they really felt like they had achieved victory. However, the city did everything it possibly could, including appealing it to the Supreme Court. But that meant that the Supreme Court then ruled in November 1956 that bus segregation in southern states like Alabama was unconstitutional, a violation of the 14th Amendment. And but still, the city fought, you know, tooth and nail. So it wasn't until over a month later that the bus boycott finally ended on December 21st, 1956.
Stuart Burns is our guest. The name of the book is To the Mountaintop, Martin Luther King's Mission and Its Meaning for America. One of the things that surprised me in the book is how early violence impacts him directly. And I did not know that part. But at this time, it wasn't long before it became very violent and he was the lightning rod.
Yes, his house was bombed just about a month and a half into the bus boycott. And he was preaching at a mass meeting, but his wife, Coretta, and a friend, and then their two-month-old daughter, Yolanda, were in the house. And if Coretta King, of course, you know, they were somewhat prepared for this to happen, to take precautions. But when she heard the thud on the porch, the normal thing to do would be to open the door to see what it was. When she heard that thud, she retreated quickly into the back room where her baby was. And there was this tremendous explosion. If she had opened the door, she would have most likely have been killed.
Do you see a change in him, or a concern, a guard that comes as a result of that?
Yes. 3 days before that, he received a phone call at midnight after a particularly tough mass meeting, and he got many of these calls every day, and this was a particularly vicious call, calling him the N-word and said, if you're not out of this town in 3 days, we're going to blow up your home and kill your family. And sure enough, that's what happened 3 days later. But after he got that phone call, he had what he has called a religious conversion, which he had not had yet. Even as a Baptist preacher, he had not yet had the obligatory conversion experience. But this was it. And he heard a voice coming from within, which he called the Holy Spirit or the voice of Jesus, telling him that if he would fight on, if he would be willing to fight on for truth and justice and righteousness, that I will be with you till the end of the time. I will never leave you alone, never alone, never alone. And so he felt at that point certain that his Holy Spirit would be with him till the very end, and that he would be willing to take whatever risks were necessary to continue to fight for righteousness and justice. So that was the turning point.
How much do you think of I'm not talking about the civil rights movement, but of his work was guided by his faith and guided by religion, the Bible, and that pastoral upbringing?
His work was completely guided by the Bible and by his Baptist faith. And he said, you know, more than once, he said, in the inner recesses of my heart, I am fundamentally a Baptist preacher. And that was true all the way to the end. And so that's one reason why I decided that what we really needed was a spiritual biography of MLK, which we had not had before. And so this, even more than the earlier edition, is what I would call a spiritual biography, where it really follows his spiritual journey, his spiritual trauma, his agony, especially toward the end, the last couple of years of his life. And he truly felt that this was a spiritual movement. And so when scholars have tried to separate the civil rights leader from the Baptist preacher, spiritual leader, it really doesn't make sense to try to separate them out. Other biographies have focused mainly on him as the civil rights leader and have minimized the spiritual essence, you know, the spiritual power behind him. So I tried to sort of bring those together, to bring the political leadership, the moral leadership, and especially the spiritual leadership together.
You write in the book, he was not the first to suggest that the worst sin was good people staying silent, but in the case of these religious leaders and many other moderates, they were remaining silent except to criticize the protest and defend law and order. Even more damaging, the moderates were not even aware of their complicity, but in flagrant denial. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill, King wrote, was more the problem than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance, worse than outright rejection. Talk a little bit about his understanding of his fellow preachers and how he overcame that, how he worked within the religious community.
Yes. First, I need to point out that a lot of times when King, even the letter from Birmingham jail that you quoted or his sermons, he would be speaking to himself as much as anyone else. So really what he said about these white clergy in Alabama during the Birmingham campaign in the spring of 1963, he could have said about himself earlier on in his life, and certainly he felt the same way about black preachers who in Birmingham in particular, the majority of black preachers did not support the Birmingham campaign. So even though he doesn't really mention, the focus is really on the Alabama clergy, including ministers and Catholic priests and rabbi who condemned his leadership of the Birmingham campaign. He was also speaking of the black, sort of a little bit indirectly, of the black leaders in Birmingham who also were very, very reluctant to support the campaign. And he himself, and when we get toward the Vietnam War, he himself was one of those good people who remained silent, and it tortured him until he was finally able to come out against the Vietnam War.
What was it, do you think, that helped him guide others in an understanding of not only preachers, but others who would stand by and not do anything? Obviously, that is a universal problem and one that the movement certainly addressed.
For one thing, he engaged in a bit of overkill when he, even as early as that first speech that I mentioned on the first night of the Montgomery bus boycott, he said, you know, if you do not have a cause for which you are willing to lay down your life, you are not fit to live. Now, that's pretty strong stuff. So clearly, a lot of his followers were not going to go that far. But by taking that really strong, almost kind of extreme position, it pushed his followers to come as close as they could. And more and more, they were willing to take whatever risk they could. Some of them took, you know, even greater risks than he took. Others would take just more than they had ever done before. So one way or another, he influenced people. Even if he wasn't always able to walk the talk himself, his words were so powerful. The words in themselves were so powerful that people would be completely moved and their lives turned upside down by them.
One of the things that I found interesting in the book and in his life, and I'm hoping you can address this a little bit, is what the ultimate goal and the intermediate goals of from time to time of moving from issue to issue of what was deemed important and should be fought and moved on, and then what they were ultimately marching towards.
Right. Even though they did not initially talk about abolishing segregation when the bus boycott started, clearly that was the goal in his mind and in the people he worked with. But initially, they were just talking about making segregation a little more polite, a little more tolerable by having a first-come, first-serve seating system that would still maintain segregation on the buses. So the goals, short-term and longer-term, evolved. But when the city would completely not cooperate, then they felt they had no, and would not negotiate, then they felt they had no choice but to challenge the whole segregation law. One of the problems was that King decided, for better or for worse, that, and the other leaders as well, that you could only really focus on one goal at a time, that you could focus on desegregation of facilities, but focusing on voting would be a whole nother area that you couldn't really do both at the same time. And what they did not talk about, just like the rest of the movement, including the more radical African-American activists, they did not really talk about economic justice until, I think, too little too late. And so it wasn't until 10 years after the bus boycott that King really decided that economic justice, ending black poverty and immiseration in the inner cities, was really the highest priority. But it took, because they seemed to feel that civil rights and voting rights had to be accomplished first. But in retrospect, it seems to me anyway that to separate them out that way, to compartmentalize the rights that they were going, or the goals that they were going after, may have been a mistake.
Stuart Burns is our guest. The name of the new book is To the Mountaintop: Martin Luther King's Mission and Its Meaning for America. We just have about 5 minutes or so, and obviously a lot of ground to cover chronologically. But let me ask you, with voting rights, and how did that victory ultimately impact him and set the agenda for what would come next?
Yes. First of all, I should say that by the time that the Voting Rights Act was signed by President Johnson in August 1965, King was suffering from a very deep depression that originated when the four girls, Denise McNair, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robinson, and Addie Mae Collins, were destroyed by the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in September 1963. That was the second major turning point after the so-called Kitchen Conversion in 1956. And that colored everything that happened subsequently. So King sunk into a deep depression that just got worse and worse. So by the time of the by the time of the Voting Rights Act, this was the greatest victory that they had been, you know, they had been struggling for so long, and yet he wasn't able to really appreciate it as he might have otherwise because, number one, he had fallen into a deep depression. Number two, he realized, because a few days after signing that important civil voting rights reform, the Watts Rebellion broke out in Los Angeles, and he realized that, well, he felt responsible for it because he felt that he had not delivered on his promises and that he had promised things even to black people in the inner city that he had not been able to fulfill. And so he felt guilt about that, and at that point decided that he would have to focus the efforts of his Southern Christian Leadership Conference on urban poverty in northern cities. And so they focused on Chicago for the next couple of years and Cleveland and other cities. But that was, again, focusing, making that shift to, I'm glad they did it when they did, but it just seemed like they could have done it sooner and it could have made some difference if they had decided to focus on poverty sooner than they did.
As I mentioned, the subtitle of the book is Martin Luther King's Mission and Its Meaning for America. As we close our time together, let us talk about that meaning for America and how you wanted to address that.
I feel clearly and passionately that Dr. King was a prophet for our time even more than he was for his own time, and that if you look at his prophecies, and especially about eliminating the evils of racism, poverty, and militarism, and I would add climate change, because I have no doubt that that would be deeply on his mind, if for no other reason than the impact of climate change is going to affect poor people around the world more than, and people of color more than any other groups. If you look at his prophecy, just about everything he said, in fact, in some ways he was ahead of the time. He would talk about depersonalization and dehumanization, and he was concerned about automation. He was concerned about the impact of technology in ways that we're experiencing now. So he really was the prophet for our time, and whatever other criticisms people might have of Dr. King, it's the prophecy that I think is truly going to endure. And it was that calling for all of us to take action, to be willing, that we really have no choice. He was really saying, especially the night before he was assassinated at Mason Temple, where he gave his last famous mountaintop speech, he was really saying, it's no longer a choice about whether to be involved in these struggles. We all are obligated to. We have to be involved. It's no longer just an option for us. We really have to devote, you know, a significant part of our lives to fighting against these evils, what I would call perils, the perils that we face. And he would be very aware of what was going on, and he would be, learning difficult lessons that he had to learn and that he talked about in his last book. I think he would be at the forefront of campaigns to deal with these perils today, and he always saw them as interrelated. They were always interwoven, and so you had to focus on all of them together. You couldn't compartmentalize your causes. You had to focus on, you know, racism, militarism, poverty, and climate change simultaneously in order to really, really make progress.
The name of the book, To the Mountaintop, Martin Luther King's Mission and Its Meaning for America. Stuart Burns, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. Really happy to be here.
A great pleasure. Again, the name of the book, To the Mountaintop, Martin Luther King's Mission and Its Meaning for America. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.